Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I am Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. It's great to be here.
Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into a single, incredibly dense source. We're tackling the Washington Post for Sunday, October 5th, 2025.
Yeah, and it's quite a snapshot. We're talking major political drama, global flashpoints, some really profound human stories packed into this one edition.
Absolutely. Our goal today for you listening is to give you that comprehensive, structured shortcut to being genuinely well-informed. We're going to unpack it all piece by piece.
And the picture that emerges from this specific day's paper, well, it's one of pretty intense chaos, you could say. Aggressive policy shifts, a government shutdown being used in a totally new way.
Yeah, and that seems like the place to start, doesn't it? The lead story, the government shutdown, the Post notes, shutdowns are almost, you know, expected these days. An autumn right of dysfunctional government.
Right, but they stress, and this is key, this one is fundamentally different, not just in scale, maybe, but in motive.
How so? What's the core difference they're highlighting?
It's being weaponized. That's the word they use. President Trump isn't just using it as a, you know, a bargaining chip for funding bills anymore. It's described as a legally shaky plan to punish his enemies.
Punish his enemies? That's strong language.
It is. And the scope is huge. It shifts the whole thing from a gridlock issue, a failure to negotiate, to an active tool of political retribution.
And the targets are clear.
Very clear. The administration is explicitly targeting blue states. We're seeing an immediate halt put on tens of billions, billions, with a B of federal dollars, money already designated for huge infrastructure projects.
Can you give an example? What kind of projects are we talking about?
Well, the most striking one mentioned is in New York. The shutdown immediately blocked $18 billion. That was money earmarked for the subway system improvements and the absolutely critical Hudson Tunnel project.
$18 billion.
Stop. And these aren't small projects. They impact the economy of the entire Northeast. Halting them like this, it's a direct political hit aimed squarely at Democratic states.
Now, normally in shutdowns, federal workers get furloughed, but eventually they get back pay once the government reopens. Is that happening this time?
That's the other huge, terrifying difference. The sources make it clear. President Trump isn't just talking furloughs. He's threatening mass firings, permanent firings,
yeah,
and gutting entire agencies.
So no promise of back pay, just you might lose your job completely.
Exactly. It changes the entire calculation. A past shutdown was a temporary hardship. Financially painful, yes, but temporary. This is an existential threat to potentially hundreds of thousands of federal workers.
2.1 million civilian federal workers suddenly facing not just a missed paycheck, but potentially the end of their careers.
Right. They're not just non-essential personnel on temporary leave. They're targets.
Yeah.
It gives the administration immense leverage to just dismantle parts of the government they don't like, regardless of what Congress eventually does on funding.
And this lands on a workforce already feeling bruised, doesn't it? The Post mentions months of layoffs already happening, strict return to office mandates.
Yeah, the human toll described is just rough. You read these quotes anonymously from federal employees, and it's painful. They feel targeted. Understandably so.
What kind of things are they saying?
There's an NIH staffer, someone doing vital non-political health research, asking, when did we become the enemy? Just think about that mindset. Going to work, knowing the people at the top see you as the problem.
Wow.
And then a Department of Homeland Security employee sums up the mood. We're just beaten. There is no hope. It's not just about money. It's a complete collapse of morale, of trust in the civil service itself.
And the impact goes way beyond the federal workers themselves, right? There's a ripple effect.
Oh, absolutely. The sources detail this through a HUD staffer, Housing and Urban Development. They're worried sick.
About what specifically?
If the shutdown drags on, processing rental assistance stops.
Right.
Or gets severely delayed. And the consequences there are terrifying. Landlords don't get paid, sure, but vulnerable tenants, they could lose their homes.
So the weapon hits people relying on basic government functions for shelter.
Exactly. It's not hitting the politicians in D.C. nearly as hard as it's hitting ordinary people who need that assistance to survive.
The political climate is getting so bad, it's actually driving people out. The Post mentions a Pentagon staffer who just quit.
Yeah. She resigned while furloughed and unpaid, decided she'd had enough, and started updating her resume right then.
What pushed her over the edge?
She cited two things specifically. First, a politically charged address Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave recently to military leaders. Second, plans within the Pentagon to start polygraphing employees and using strict NDAs to stop leaks.
Polygraphs and NDAs?
Yes. She felt the administration was violating core principles of civil service, constitutional principles even, and she just refused to be part of it anymore. It's not just financial damage, it's a brain drain. Experienced people are leaving.
And this all seems to feed directly into this broader strategy the president is now openly talking about, Project 2025.
Right. The shutdown isn't just chaos, it's the tool to implement Project 2025. Trump is explicitly saying he wants to permanently cut what he calls Democrat agencies, labeling them a political scam.
So it's intentional demolition.
Yeah, intentional institutional demolition, yeah. And the Post identifies the key figure here as Budget Director Russell Vought. He apparently spent the last 4 years meticulously planning how to use mechanisms like the shutdown to make rapid, deep, lasting changes to the federal government structure.
And the ambition is significant.
Huge. They quote former Speaker Newt Gingrich saying Vought aims to eliminate more jobs than Elon Musk and DOGE. That's quite a comparison.
Yeah.
This isn't about efficiency. It's about fundamentally changing the nature of the federal workforce, moving away from a nonpartisan civil service.
But surely this kind of aggressive tactic carries political risks, even for Republicans.
Absolutely. Senator Cramer, a Republican, is quoted warning exactly that. He says using the shutdown this way as blatant retribution risks squandering any moral high ground Republicans might have had in budget fights.
Because it makes the motive so transparent.
Exactly. You can't really blame Democrats for the shutdown when the administration is openly celebrating it as a chance to dismantle agencies and punish political opponents. It makes it much harder for moderate Republicans to defend.
So how are Democrats responding to this? The sources say their mood has shifted.
Dramatically. They're showing defiance, is the word used. They have abandoned attempts at conciliation. The old playbook is out.
Is there a quote that captures that shift?
Yeah, Senator Chris Van Hollen puts it very bluntly. You should never try to appease a bully. That signals a real hardening of their stance. They seem ready to endure this shutdown rather than negotiate under this kind of duress.
Do they have a specific rallying point? Something concrete they're demanding?
Yes, and it's politically very savvy. They've united around demanding an extension of the Affordable Care Act health coverage subsidies.
Ah, the ACA subsidies. Why is that such a strong position?
Because it's incredibly popular. Nearly three quarters of Americans support extending those subsidies. So it gives Democrats a clear, popular, morally defensible thing they are fighting for, which directly counters the administration's narrative of just wanting to cut and punish.
And this fight isn't just in D.C., is it? It's playing out at the state level, too.
Very aggressively. You see state leaders pushing back hard. Illinois Governor Pritzker was already known for being combative with the administration, telling residents to stand up to federal agents.
But someone else changed their tune.
Yes. California Governor Newsom. He had previously tried to find, you know, common ground. But the Post reports his tone changed sharply after federal troops were sent into Los Angeles. Now he shifted to full resistance mode.
So the federal actions are forcing governors to draw firmer lines.
It seems so. The weaponization of the shutdown, the troop deployments, it's pushing state leaders into more defensive postures.
Speaking of unusual executive actions, we have to talk about this Trump commemorative coin pitch. This sounds wild.
It really does. The Treasury Department is apparently pitching a new $1 coin for the 250th anniversary of the U.S. next year.
Okay, an anniversary coin makes sense. What's the issue?
The design. It would feature President Trump's profile. And on the reverse side, the phrase fight, 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 which references the assassination attempt on him in 2024.
Wait, putting a living president on a coin, isn't that illegal?
That's exactly the conflict. Long-standing U.S. code mandates that only deceased individuals can appear on currency or securities. It's a tradition going back to the founding, meant to separate the U.S. from European monarchies, putting living rulers on coins.
So this directly violates the law.
It appears to. Plus, the specific law for the 250th anniversary coin itself restricts portraits of living people, even on the reverse side. So legal experts quoted in the Post suggest the administration is either just ignoring the law or playing some very extreme word games to try and justify it, essentially turning currency into a political statement.
Wow. Okay. This theme of aggressive federal power, pushing legal boundaries, it seems like a good bridge to the next major section in the Post, justice and immigration. We see more federal overreach, sometimes violently.
Yeah, the situation reported out of Chicago is deeply concerning. Violent clashes erupted over an ICE crackdown, things escalated, and a woman was shot during the operation.
And the accounts of what happened differ?
Drastically. Completely contradictory, actually. The Department of Homeland Security says their agents fired defensive shots only after their vehicles were rammed during the operation.
But immigrant rights groups say something else.
Yes, the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights claims their initial information suggests the agents actually crashed into a civilian vehicle first.
Yeah.
And that triggered the chaos leading to the shooting.
A huge discrepancy. And the federal response.
Regardless of who caused the crash, President Trump authorized 300 National Guard troops to be sent into Chicago, explicitly against Governor Pritzker's wishes. Another clear assertion of federal power over state authority.
But contrast that with Portland. There, a judge actually blocked troops.
Yes, and this is really significant. Federal Judge Corinne J. Immergett, notably, a Trump appointee, temporarily blocked the deployment of federal troops into Portland.
On what grounds?
She cited Oregon's 10th Amendment rights of the state's right to control its own National Guard. Her language was powerful. She said, "This is a nation of constitutional law, not martial law." And she found the administration's justification for military intervention simply untethered to the facts.
So even a judge appointed by Trump pushed back on constitutional grounds.
It shows there are still some checks, even within the system, against potential overreach.
Now, looking at immigration policies themselves, there's this new voluntary return program targeting unaccompanied children, offering them money to go home.
That's right. $2,500 for unaccompanied migrant kids aged 14 and older if they agree to return home voluntarily.
How is DHS framing this?
They call it strictly voluntary aid to help kids reunite with families back home.
But advocates see it differently.
Immediately condemned it, called it cash bribes for kids. The worry is pretty obvious. $2,500 is a huge amount of money in some home countries. It could easily pressure extremely vulnerable minors, kids who might have valid asylum claims, to give up their legal rights without fully understanding the consequences. They might be surrendering life-saving protections.
And the human cost of this enforcement environment is highlighted in a couple of individual cases the Post covers. First, a journalist was deported.
Mario Guevara. It's a chilling story. He's an Emmy-winning Spanish language reporter. He was arrested while covering a protest. All the charges against him were quickly dropped.
So he should have been released.
You'd think so. But instead, he was transferred to ICE custody. And they deported him by invoking an old asylum denial from 2012. This is despite him fleeing El Salvador 2 decades ago due to threats and building a life and career here.
What's the significance of that?
His lawyer pointed out the terrifying precedent. A journalist doing his job, covering a protest, gets arrested, charges dismissed, but he's deported anyway. It shows how the system can be used against people, even those with some profile.
And then there's the Venezuelan singer, Davidcito 59. He went viral, got asylum, but was still detained.
Yeah, Claudio David Balcain Gonzalez. He won his asylum case in July. But the Post reports ICE kept him detained for another 63 days after he won.
Why? On what grounds?
Experts called it unlawful detention. He was apparently questioned repeatedly about alleged ties to a criminal gang, Trendyaragua ties he strongly denied. They even refused to transfer him to a less traumatic detention facility while holding him unjustly. It just shows the power the enforcement system still has, even over someone who's technically won their case.
Shifting focus slightly within the federal law enforcement structure itself, the FBI is making some changes under Director Kash Patel, cutting ties with some groups.
Yes, this is significant. Patel has formally distanced the FBI from 2 major civil rights organizations. The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is a prominent Jewish civil rights group.
That the FBI partnered with for decades on extremism education, right?
For decades, yes.
Yeah.
And also the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Patel publicly called the ADL a political front as part of the justification.
Why cut ties with groups that specialize in tracking hate and extremism? What's the rationale?
It seems to be a response to sustained pressure from right-wing groups. These groups have long argued that organizations like the SPLC show bias against conservatives and Christians, often pointing to things like that leaked 2023 memo that mentioned extremists being drawn to certain traditional Catholic circles.
So Patel is trying to appear less politically biased.
That seems to be the framing. Signaling a new direction for the FBI, trying to insulate it from those criticisms, even if it means losing expertise from groups that have tracked organized hate for years.
And the SPLC's response?
They defended their mission, basically saying their job is to expose hate and extremism wherever they find it, regardless of the political ideology involved.
Okay, so domestic policy is clearly marked by ideological fights and aggressive enforcement. Let's pivot now to the global stage. The Post covers the Israel-Hamas peace talks, which sound incredibly fragile.
Fragile is definitely the word. On the surface, there was some initial cautious optimism. Both sides conditionally accepted President Trump's 20-point peace plan, they agreed to talk.
Conditionally accepted. That's a key phrase, isn't it? What are the conditions?
And that's where it gets tricky. The conditions reveal these massive, maybe insurmountable, gaps between them.
Okay, break down the core conflict in those conditions.
Hamas says yes, they'll release all Israeli hostages, provided it ensures an end to the war and a complete withdrawal from the Strip. Notice what's missing.
Disarmament.
Exactly. No mention of disarming, which was a central part of Trump's plan.
And Israel's conditions. What does Netanyahu demand?
Pretty much the opposite. Netanyahu demands Hamas release all hostages while Israeli forces remain deep inside the Gaza Strip, potentially for years. And then after that, Hamas must disarm and demilitarize.
So Israel wants continued military control and a buffer zone. Hamas wants full withdrawal and sovereignty. No disarmament yet.
Basically, yes. It looks like both sides agreed to talk mainly to reiterate their core demands, which are mutually exclusive at this point.
And how do people in Gaza see this? The Post includes their perspective.
It's grim. Profound exhaustion and deep distrust. They basically fear both sides are just playing us. They think any ceasefire will just be a pause, a tactical break, and the war will inevitably start again once hostages are exchanged. There's just no faith in a lasting peace right now.
This conflict is also having major repercussions here in the U.S., specifically within the American Jewish community. The Post poll you mentioned earlier sounds groundbreaking.
It really is. The poll documents what the Post calls a potential historic breach between U.S. Jews and Israel over the Gaza war. The level of criticism is startling.
What are the key numbers?
Get this. 61% of U.S. Jews surveyed said they believe Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza. And 39% went even further, saying they believe Israel has committed genocide.
Wow. 61% saying war crimes. That's unprecedented internal criticism, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've never really seen this level of public, internal moral questioning of Israeli actions within the community before.
Does this mean a total break? Or is it more complicated?
It's definitely more complicated.
Yeah.
Because despite that strong moral condemnation of the current actions, the underlying bond seems to remain. 76% still say Israel's existence is vital for the future of the Jewish people.
So they're separating the state's existence from the current government's policies.
It looks that way. They seem to be grappling with this difficult distinction. There's clearly significant internal turmoil about how much support the U.S. should continue providing, given these concerns.
And the divide runs along political lines, too.
Sharply. Approval of Israel's military actions. 8 out of 10 Republicans approve, but only 3 out of 10 Democrats. Mm-hmm. Education level also plays a role.
And who do they blame for the war continuing?
Blame is spread pretty widely. Large majorities hold Hamas responsible, 91%, but also Israel, 80%, Netanyahu specifically, 86%, and even the U.S., 61%. There's a sense that almost everyone involved shares blame for the conflict dragging on.
Okay, let's shift continents now. Big political change potentially happening in Japan. Sanae Takeuchi looks set to become the country's first female prime minister.
Yes, a conservative security hawk. Her rise comes at a time of unusual political instability for Japan, actually. The ruling LDP party recently lost its outright majority.
So she's taking over the world's fourth largest economy facing challenges.
Exactly. Rising prices, those regional tensions we always talk about. And she's known as a protege of the late Shinzo Abe, so expect hardline stances on defense, security, immigration. Though, interestingly, she has vowed to put more women in her cabinet.
What are the likely geopolitical ripple effects of her leadership, given that national stance?
Well, experts worry her more assertive nationalism could complicate things. For example, her rhetoric about visiting disputed islands is almost certainly going to increase friction with China, which claims those same islands.
And relations with South Korea.
That could also be strained. Her premiership might undermine some recent, very delicate efforts to improve ties. Historically, South Korea is wary of Japanese leaders who lean heavily into nationalist narratives or challenge historical interpretations aggressively.
Okay, we've covered global tensions, domestic political fights. Now let's look at another kind of power, the consolidation of media and economic influence, starting with this Ellison Media empire.
Yeah, this is a big one. Lori Ellison, the tech billionaire, and his son David. The Post describes them building an unrivaled empire. It spans old media like CDS, movies, TV networks.
And a stake in TikTok.
And a forthcoming major stake in TikTok. That combination is huge. It represents a real shift, potentially, blending traditional media gatekeepers with the ultimate new media fire hose.
And the politics are complicated. Larry Ellison's a major Trump donor. David Ellison donated to Biden.
Right. That immediately raises massive questions, doesn't it, about influence, editorial independence. David Ellison promised he doesn't want to politicize the company.
But
he's already appointed someone known for campaigning against wokeism to lead the network. So the Post suggests a kind of culture clash is already brewing, and questions about ideological tilt are definitely there.
Is neutrality even possible with owners having such clear opposing political ties?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? When you control that much of what people see, CBS News, movies, TikTok feeds you, become a huge target. Especially when a sitting president actively talks about punishing media outlets he dislikes. Maintaining neutrality looks almost impossible. It really makes you, the listener, question how much you can trust the information when the owners have such deep political skin in the game.
Shifting to economic power now, tariffs. President Trump is using the Section 232 trade law in some novel ways.
It's extremely novel. Section 232 is supposed to be about protecting national security. It lets the president impose tariffs if imports threaten defense readiness.
But he's applying it to kitchen cabinets, roller skates.
Exactly. Kitchen cabinets and roller skates are the examples given. The administration's argument is, well, kind of a stretch. They're saying rising imports of these everyday goods could somehow endanger the supply chains needed for national defense if, say, we lost access to foreign suppliers.
That sounds like a very broad definition of national security.
Extraordinarily broad. The Post notes this makes the Trump 2.0 administration arguably the most economically interventionist U.S. government since FDR's New Deal.
And that New Deal comparison isn't just rhetorical. George Will's column digs into it.
Right. Will cites economic historian George Selgin, who argues there's a parallel between New Deal progressives and today's national conservatives. Both, he argues, embrace heavy government intervention in the economy, despite historical evidence of failure.
Failure? How so? Didn't the New Deal end the Depression?
Well, Selgin's analysis, cited by Will, argues, no, not really. He points out that interventionist programs like the National Recovery Administration, which basically encourage industries to form cartels and limit competition, didn't fix the underlying problems.
What's the evidence for that?
The unemployment numbers. Selgin notes unemployment was still incredibly high, 14.6% at the end of the 1930s. That's higher than the peak of the Great Recession decades later.
Wow.
Plus, you had programs aimed at creating prosperity through scarcity, paying farmers to destroy crops while people were hungry. The argument is that this kind of government-directed allocation of capital, whether New Deal or Trump 2.0 style, tends to stifle dynamism and create inefficiencies, potentially repeating past mistakes.
Okay, let's transition to some broader societal issues now. Public health first, the Post looks at adults who miss childhood vaccines.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece looking at the consequences for adults whose parents opted out of routine vaccinations due to religious or personal beliefs years ago.
What kind of consequences are they facing now?
Real ones. There's Lacey Madison, who only found out she lacked most standard immunizations when she got a hospital job that required proof of immunity. She had to get decades worth of shots all at once.
Ouch.
And Emma Sonis, who still deals with long-term health issues from a severe case of whooping cough she got as a child. She had a sleeve sitting upright for months because the coughing was so bad.
And this isn't just a few isolated cases. Exemptions are rising.
According to CDC data cited in the Post, yes, exemptions are up in 36 states. 17 states are now over the 5% exemption mark, which starts to worry public health officials about herd immunity.
Why is this happening more now?
It seems vaccines might be victims of their own success. Diseases like measles, polio, they're not everyday realities for most people anymore. So the fear of the disease fades, and maybe the perceived risk of the vaccine itself seems larger, fueling skepticism, however misplaced.
We're seeing similar culture war themes playing out in Europe too, right? Italy's government under Giorgia Meloni? Oh,
absolutely. A clear example of the anti-woke agenda spreading. Meloni's government is trying to ban school lessons on gender relativism and restrict access to transition-related health care for minors.
Just like the Don't Say Gay bills and similar efforts here and in Eastern Europe?
Exactly like that. It mirrors moves in places like Hungary and Bulgaria. The Italian proposal even mandates government-approved alternative lessons if schools cut the controversial topics, basically making it too expensive for many schools to teach sensitive social issues at all.
And finally, in societal shifts, a really interesting story about trying to revive a town in former East Germany, Eisenhüttenstadt.
Yeah, the former Stalinstadt. It's facing massive population decline, lost more than half its people since reunification in 1990. So they tried something creative.
What did they do?
It's called Probewohnen trial living. They offer just two spots for people to come live rent-free for a couple of weeks to see if they like the town.
Two spots. How much interest was there?
Staggering. They got 2,000 applications from all over the world. For two temporary spots, it completely blew away expectations.
What does that huge interest tell us?
It really highlights the ongoing economic problems in Eastern Germany. Wages are still 15-20% lower than in the West. People have been leaving for decades. That lingering sense of being left behind, the lack of equal opportunity, that's what fuels support for parties like the far-right AfD.
The AfD did well there.
40% of the vote in Eisenhüttenstadt in last election. This trial living program, while creative, is really a small gesture against decades of deep structural economic disparity.
Okay, that brings us towards the end. Looking at consumer life, local DC stuff, and culture, let's start practical. Saving money. The Post had tips on negotiation.
Yeah, a really useful piece. The main takeaway. A lot of your biggest bills are actually negotiable. Most people just don't try or feel uncomfortable asking.
What are the key areas they suggest focusing on?
Three big ones. First, credit card interest rates. The average rate is over 20% now. Companies often will lower your rate if you ask, especially if you're a good customer. They don't want to lose you.
Okay, credit cards. What else?
Utilities, if you live in a deregulated state. There are 13 states plus DC where you can shop around or negotiate with suppliers.
And the third, biggest one.
Rent. Housing is usually the single largest expense for people. Asking your landlord to negotiate the rent when your lease is up, totally worth trying, especially if you've been a good tenant. Even a small reduction saves a lot over a year.
Good practical advice.
Yeah.
Now, shifting to a classic conflict, environment versus economy, the Boundary Waters mining issue.
The Trump administration is apparently moving to reverse a Biden-era ban.
Yeah.
This would greenlight mining near the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in Minnesota. It's the world's largest undeveloped copper-nickel deposit.
So environmentalists are obviously concerned.
Deeply concerned. People like Becky Rahm, who's quoted, "fear unavoidable pollution." They argue copper mining in wet environments like that watershed almost inevitably leads to contamination, potentially causing permanent damage to a critical water source.
But the economic argument for mining is strong, too.
It's huge. Proponents talk about 750 full-time jobs, high salaries averaging over $100,000. Plus, the argument that the U.S. needs these critical minerals, copper, nickel, to reduce reliance on foreign suppliers, especially China, the company involved, Twin Metals, has already sunk $600 million into planning this.
A really tough trade-off. Now let's look at local DC issues. Serious budget problems leading to healthcare cuts.
Yeah, this sounds painful for residents. DC is starting a two-year phase-out of its healthcare alliance program. This affects about 30,000 residents.
Who relies on that program?
It provides essential non-emergency care, mainly for people ineligible for Medicaid, including many undocumented immigrants.
Yeah.
Officials blame a massive $1 billion budget shortfall.
Why such a huge shortfall?
They point to federal funding cuts from the Trump administration, lower income tax revenues, and the ongoing slump in downtown commercial real estate, which hits city revenue hard.
And the impact of cutting this program?
Immediate and severe. They're already cutting nearly 3,000 people due to stricter income limits. Adults are losing coverage for things like regular doctor visits, mental health services, vision, dental. Advocates warn people will just skip necessary care, leading to worse health outcomes and overcrowding in emergency rooms, which might become their only option.
Also in D.C., a bit of courtroom drama, a judge asking for civility.
Yes, Chief U.S. District Judge James Boasberg. It happened after an assistant U.S. attorney working for Jeanine Pirro's office used some pretty unprofessional language in a court filing.
What did they say?
Accused another judge of bloviating.
Bloviating in a legal filing.
Yeah. It stemmed from a really unusual situation where federal prosecutors tried to get an indictment from a local D.C. grand jury after a federal grand jury had already refused to indict, issued a no bill.
That sounds odd.
Judge Boasberg called it exceedingly rare and very unseemly. He asked the prosecutors to legally justify why they were doing it. It was their angry response to that request, accusing the judge of bias and bloviating, that prompted Boasberg to formally remind them about civility and professional responsibility.
Okay, let's wrap up with some cultural highlights from the Post. Surprising investment advice from Jane Goodall.
Ah, yeah, it's a neat connection. The lesson is patience. Goodall spent decades patiently observing chimps, leading to groundbreaking science. The article connects that patience to financial success, specifically the rise of 401k millionaires.
How so?
On average, people who become 401k millionaires did it by saving and investing steadily for almost 30 years. Slow, steady, disciplined patience wins in finance, just like it did for Goodall in science.
Interesting parallel. And changes in rock memoirs?
Yeah, a move away from standard autobiographies. Bands like Huggy Bear or Swizz.
Yeah.
Their memoirs use collage, multiple voices, nonlinear structures. They feel more like old punk fanzines cut and paste, chaotic, reflecting the energy of the music scene itself.
And big news for literary fiction fans. Thomas Pynchon has a new book and a film adaptation.
Yes. Pynchon's new novel is called Shadow Ticket. But maybe even bigger buzz is Paul Thomas Anderson directing a film adaptation of Pynchon's 1990 novel, Vineland.
What's the angle on the adaptation?
Anderson's film is called One Battle After Another. He apparently kept the basic plot activist chased by a government figure, but updated the politics sharply. The book was rooted in the Reagan-era war on drugs. The film shifts it to now, making the antagonist run an immigrant detention center and use a raid on a sanctuary city as cover for a personal vendetta.
Very contemporary update. And we have to mention Abdul's Cats from DC Culture.
Such a great story. Abdul Rahim, big guy, 6'4", has fostered over 200 kittens in DC over 6 years. His social media account, Abdul's Cats, has like 600,000 followers. Is defying stereotypes and has become his full-time job through sponsorships. He says fostering helps his own anxiety too. Just a lovely story.
And quickly, the food critic's dream, dining only on appetizers.
Huh. Yes. The argument is that chefs often put their most creative energy into starters, while entrees can sometimes be more predictable. They mention Risika's Palak Chaat, that amazing crispy spinach dish, as a prime example of a starter that became iconic.
Finally, super quick sports notes.
Familiar woes for Maryland football blew a 20-point lead against Washington. Caps hockey making final roster cuts looks like LaPierre is in. Milano and Miroshnichenko battling for a spot. And sadly, former NFL QB Mark Sanchez was arrested on misdemeanor charges after being involved in a stabbing incident in Indianapolis.
Okay, wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. From the very real threat to federal jobs and livelihoods, to those fragile peace talks in Gaza, the immense power being consolidated in media by figures like the Ellisons, and that intense local fight over mining near the Boundary Waters.
Yeah, and when you step back and look at it all together, the Ellison Empire shaping news, the FBI deciding who counts as a credible civil rights partner, the shutdown be used as a political weapon, the competing narratives in Gaza, a really strong theme emerges, doesn't it? Control. Controlling the information. Controlling the narrative. Defining reality itself. That seems to be the underlying goal for so many of the powerful players in almost every story we've discussed.
That's a powerful takeaway. And for you listening, the challenge isn't just absorbing all this information, this dense snapshot from one Sunday paper. It's figuring out which facts, once you piece them together, really resonate. Which ones make you think differently, maybe even push you towards some kind of informed action, or at least a changed perspective.
So that leads us to our final thought for you to chew on this week. Of everything we unpacked today, the threat of mass federal layoffs with no back pay, that stunning 61% of U.S. Jews saying Israel committed war crimes, the fact you might be able to negotiate your 20% credit card interest rate down, or the possibility of $1 coin featuring a living president and fight, fight, fight.
Mm.
What single detail, what specific story sticks with you?
And how does that one detail challenge an assumption you had before you started listening today? Something to think about. Thank you for joining us for this intensive deep dive.
Until next time.